happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Verlinde. And as always, that's John Rauhaus playing in the background. 2020 has been an incredibly weird and depressing year, especially for musicians who obviously can't do concerts or festivals. I know a lot of album release dates have been pushed around because of COVID. But throughout all this, Canadian singer-songwriter Daniel Romano did something thoroughly remarkable. He started releasing albums. At the beginning of this, in March, I believe, when not much was happening aside from a lot of live streaming on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube, he started putting out records every Wednesday on his Bandcamp page. And these were real records. This wasn't him with an acoustic guitar in front of a Zoom recorder. These were fully produced, amazing records. And he kept doing it. One week he released a concept album that was basically a cover of Bob Dylan's Infidels record, as though the Plugs were Dylan's backing band. Another week he put out a book of love poems. The surprises just kept coming, and for fans of Daniel Romano like myself, it was this amazing, quirky, magical streak that no one ever wanted to end. And I have to say, it really gave a lot of folks something to love and be happy about during a really bleak time. Eventually, he stopped putting out records every Wednesday, but I'm happy to say that on September 18th of 2020, Daniel Romano is releasing his ninth full-length record for 2020, How Ill Thy World Is Ordered. And you can hear the first single from that on all the usual streaming platforms. I used that album's release as a great excuse to follow up with Daniel Romano and hear what happened earlier this year and how he was able to pull off all of these records. I had so many questions for him, and we talked about all sorts of stuff. Daniel is a bit of a shapeshifter. He's bounced from Americana to garage rock to British folk and all points in between. He's changed his look a bunch of times too over the last several years. So I'm guessing he likes a little aura of mystery around him, but he was so honest and open about his creative process. I think you're going to love this chat. Before we get to that, our 46th issue of the Fretboard Journal is finally printing now, long time in the making. I can't wait to share that with you. We have both digital PDF editions as well as the keepsake print edition that you can subscribe to. In that issue, John Leventhal and Roseanne Cash, and a bunch more. We really packed in more stories than I think we ever thought we could pack into 128 pages. So if you want to support this show, if you like what we're about, if you've been enjoying these podcasts, we hope you will subscribe. It's the best way to help us out. Go over to fretboardjournal.com and just click on the subscribe tab. And don't forget, if you're listening to a lot of podcasts right now, we do put out a couple of other podcasts, and I think we have a third, a brand new one on the way later this year. Luthier on Luthier is our podcast where Michael Bashkin interviews fellow guitar makers every month. So much interesting stuff on that, as well as the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast, where amp tech Skip Simmons fields your questions on all things tube amp. We're about to celebrate our 50th episode of The Truth About Vintage Amps, and we have a ton of cool surprises and giveaways in store, so I hope you will tune into that episode. We also just launched a Patreon for that show, which is a great way to support Skip and all that we're doing over there. Before we get to my talk with Daniel, a shout out to our friends over at Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire lineup of gig bags and pedal boards and pedal board bags. Everything they do is so cool and so well built and pretty much indestructible. I love all the Mono products that I have and can wholeheartedly endorse them to all of you. Our other sponsor, of course, is our friends over at Retrofret Vintage Guitars over in New York. They have a 1964 Fender Princeton Reverb amp for sale right now. It looks incredible. It's got the original Oxford speaker and reverb tank. They have a 1967 Guild M65 hollow body electric that also looks fantastic. And on the cool but cheaper end of the spectrum, a 65 Burns Jazz Split Sound Electric. I don't know how they get all these Burns guitars, but they continue to every single week. So head on over to retrofret.com and don't forget that they do incredible repair and restoration work as well. All right, here is my chat with the one and only Daniel Romano. We had him at the Fretboard Journal a year or two ago. We did a video with him, but it was so great to fill in the gaps and hear the story of his incredible creative streak of 2020. I hope you enjoy it. Daniel, thanks for talking to us. You have done, in this incredibly difficult and weird year, you have done something thoroughly remarkable by being one of the most prolific people that I know in the music industry. Before we get into some of the details on that and what you're up to, how are you holding up right now, and where are you?
I'm in Alpine, Texas currently, and I'm holding up well. I'm just, sort of working on this and that and keeping busy.
Have you been in Texas through the entire pandemic?
More or less, yeah.
Okay. I had visions of you holed up in some sort of Big Pink thing in Canada, churning out records every week. But is Texas home
now? There was a portion that was like that. No, Texas is home for a little bit, and we'll be going back to Ontario mid-September.
Okay. Is it easy? I'm guessing it's not easy to get across that border. And
no.
Yeah.
No. There are some loose ends that need to be tied up first.
Okay. So how many albums are you officially up to for 2020?
I don't know. It's 9 or 10 or something, somewhere in there.
And for a while there, especially early on in this crazy year when, mm-hmm. people were doing live streaming and going on Instagram Live and that was their way to stay connected. For a while there, every single Wednesday, you put out a brand new record, like a real record, not just some demos.
Yeah.
Were those records recorded long ago and finally saw the light of day?
There were two. There were two that were pretty much finished, and the rest were fully conceived and produced in the time frame. Or maybe there's three.
Yeah. Were you just having this amazing creative streak by being locked at home, or how did that come about?
I mean, that's kind of how I always function anyway. I'm always locked at home.
Okay.
Working, So I don't know. It didn't seem, I just had no distractions, I guess, which by distractions, I mean like other forms of work, like touring or thinking about touring and that kind of thing. But I mean, there are various, different approaches to the process that I've dealt with in the past, and so I can keep it interesting for myself by changing those processes depending on the project,
What can you elaborate on that a little bit? Is that instrumentation
not,
or
not lineup? in any kind of interesting way? I guess like it would be like starting with words or music or starting with drums and that kind of thing, and those usually take the material to a different place so that I'm not constantly repeating myself.
Got it. And the,
to keep myself interested.
Yeah. And I think, all of those albums were and are incredible. I know I listen to them all the time. One of the ones that was sort of the most put the biggest smile on my face was that Plugs album. Was that one of the ones that had been pre-recorded?
Oh yeah. No. We had talked about doing that for a long time, kind of as a joke, because of the Letterman performance and how Desire actually was, or I mean, sorry, Infidels, and you know, just imagine what that would be like. So we did our best to bring it to fruition.
Yeah, you've been compared to Dylan more than once. Are you a huge Dylan fan?
I mean, I like Bob Dylan.
When you talk about we for these albums, do you guys all kind of live in the same vicinity?
Yeah.
Okay. Under the same roof?
Yeah, everybody's... No, but the furthest person is like a half an hour away.
Okay. Can you talk to me, one of the, you know, there was a break there. I don't know whether you just needed a break from putting out records or not. But then the Alias Ensemble came out. How did that record come about? Because it was completely different than everything else you've been doing.
Yeah, well, that had actually been done before all of this. And we kind of waffled on whether it was done or whether, you know, but yeah, that was a project that David Nardi and I had conceived doing, I think last fall, and then did it, and I didn't want to sing those songs, and so we kind of went through the process of trying to choose the right person to do it. And I had never worked with Kelly Sloan. I just knew, of her more than I even knew her. and then she graciously agreed to take part and, you know, did an amazing job.
Yeah.
All the performances were, you know, better than I could have ever done, which is a real thrill for me, because I'd rather not sing any of my songs, really.
Really?
Well, I mean, no, I don't mean that. I like singing them, but I mean, I think that everybody else is better at it than me, and it's interesting to hear other people doing it, or it's rewarding, I guess, to hear it.
Were there demos of that album where you did all the singing?
Probably just like quick little, like whatever the recording I made when I wrote it, whatever that was.
Yeah.
I've never really made demos, but I guess that's what that would be. Like the first pass performance of the song once it was written.
Mm-hmm. And that one definitely, you know, like British folk inspired. Was there a particular record or band that you were kind of like, let's do the 2020 version of this?
I mean, probably like the first Ann Briggs record, but with instrumentation,
mm-hmm.
or maybe probably Shirley Collins.
Yeah.
We were probably aping that a bit.
Do you listen to a lot of that music?
I do, yeah.
Okay. Since you said that you're in Texas now, I'm just curious, what is your workspace or studio space like? How important is that to you in Canada? How different is it in Texas? Are you still writing and recording constantly?
Yeah. You know, I have a D24 and a two channel interface. And that's it. And Pro Tools, the operating system.
And is that what you're using in Canada when you're recording all these things?
I mean, for the stuff that we were doing really fast, yes. I also have like a, what is it called? MCI H16 tape machine.
Okay.
That we use. But when we're kind of banging it out quick, it's usually just like an Apollo into Tools, and that's it.
But recording live straight the whole band into a two-channel interface?
No, into an eight-channel interface.
Okay.
Into an eight-channel. But I only have a two-channel interface here.
Okay.
which I bought on Craigslist when I got here.
All right. And guitar-wise?
I have two Greco SGs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Why two? Why, you just needed a backup of the one?
I just thought it'd be funny to have two of the exact same guitar. Dave Nardi, who plays with me, has two Greco Les Pauls, and so I thought it would be a funny thing for the stage to just be like Grecos only. So that's the new rule.
That's the new rule. All
I
right.
don't know what our bass. I don't know what the bass player is going to get up to, but he knows he's got to downgrade to a Greco. yeah.
Is that the guitar you're doing like your songwriting on right now?
Well, sort of. Yeah. Well, actually, my fiance has a Sigma, which is also Japanese. Yeah. So there's an acoustic guitar,
okay.
As well, which I probably use more often for writing.
Okay. Are you still writing a lot right now or taking a break?
Yeah. I mean, mostly poems actually, but there's been a few songs. I mean, I have another record, which I'm not supposed to say, that I'm just working on that will probably not see the light of day for at least a year. But, Kenny, who always mixes everything for me, is in the process of mixing it now. But I did drums down here at an acquaintance's little home studio and bass. And I had before I came here, I had all the rest of the, like, everything else within the song finished, basically. But I think I wrote a few of them down here.
Great. Wow.
Anyway, yeah, just like still just going, I guess, whatever.
Yeah. And you have a record, like a big record coming out very shortly.
Like an actual record, yeah.
How do you distinguish? Because the other ones sound pretty darn good.
I think it was because we had given it to You've Changed before all of this and decided that was going to be, you know, and it's like, it's all, it's like live off the floor, just learn the songs. It's got like an energy to it that doesn't really exist on the other sort of more studio based records that I was making over the last couple months.
Okay.
And I don't know. I mean, I have a weird relationship with it because it's old to me, but that's kind of how it always goes.
Yeah. What was the fastest turnaround with the string of five or six records that came out every Wednesday between, like, you were done recording and it came out?
I mean, it was always the night before that we were getting mixes back.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it was fun. It was unnecessary, but, you know, it was a, you know, it's a weird time and it's good to stay active, I guess.
Could you get yourself back into that mindset, or are you kind of glad you're done with it?
I mean, I'm still in it.
Yeah.
You know, but I just think well, pretty much Steve at You've Changed told me to stop putting records out.
Really?
Yeah, so that, you know, the one that's actually coming out can exist for a while on its own, which I think makes sense.
It
I
does.
Guess from like a business perspective.
Yeah. I have to say though, and I'm not alone because I know lots of amazing musicians who also are following you with bated breath, to use the only sports analogy that I'll ever use in my entire career, because I'm not into sports. Like, it felt like when you watch a guy like throw free throws in basketball or whatever and keep making them. And it just felt good during a time of uncertainty to know that every Wednesday something might, like some little present from you might show up in our feeds.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Yeah. Well, it was fun to make those. I don't want to call them, I mean, you called them gifts and I think that's nice, but I, and you know, it was just nice to to be busy, I guess, you know, in that way. And like, I mean, like everything I do is always so project based, and it's more like, okay, here's an idea. Can I bring it to fruition? And that's usually the extent of the planning before the process begins, you know?
Is there sort of a instantaneous decision of like, here's who's going to be on it, here's what it's going to sound like, let's go for it? Or does it evolve?
Well, for any project, I always first make a list of somewhat absurd rules for myself.
Okay, let's
hear it. And for everyone. Well, it's not that absurd, but for How Will My World Is Ordered, which is the record, that, like the proper record, I guess, that will be coming out in September. The rule was no one can like know the songs beforehand, and everything is tracked live, and you only get three takes, not including two passes through the song to learn the song before we roll tape.
Wow. It's like a game.
And also immediately choosing the take and deleting the others so that there's no option.
Damn. Strict.
Which is usually how I do everything anyway, but I usually do that alone.
Mm-hmm.
So it was much more fun to put the heat on everybody, you know?
Yeah.
And it's captured, you know, there's like beautiful mistakes and weirdness all throughout it that you wouldn't be able to get if you were, you know, nitpicking or doing it better. You know
sure.
what I mean?
Yeah. What have been like the most ridiculous rules you've put in place for a project?
I made this record called Finally Free, mm-hmm. and this was only for myself, you know, because I did it alone. But when I made that record, the rule was I'm only using one microphone and I'm never moving its position. So I sat at the desk and I had it, you know, in vocal position, basically. And so everything you hear is recorded wherever it happened to be, but into that position. You know, so I put like an amp for the bass to my left on the floor, but it was mic'd where my vocal is. And everything is like that, the acoustic guitar, the whatever the hell else happens on that thing. I never, you know, and I put the electric guitar amp on the other side and all that kind of thing.
That's incredible.
Well, it was kind of just a stupid idea that it sort of worked.
It did work. I mean, that album's fantastic.
Because I was like, how am I going to capture like what feels kind of like a live performance by multiple people by myself?
Yeah.
So that was my...
What microphone was that?
It was an AKG D19.
Okay.
Which was stolen.
Oh.
So, and that's why I bought the D24.
Got it.
The quote unquote Sinatra mic. So it's basically the same as the D19, but has a different sort of capsule on the end of it or whatever.
Yeah. Would you do that again? That
but
rule?
They're cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. I mean, if I was making something like that, I would probably try that again. But I don't know how it would, you know what I mean? If everyone was actually playing at the same time and I was doing that, which somebody told me that the newer, like Love and Theft and those records, yeah. that era of Dylan records, is mostly the band coming through his vocal mic in the final mix.
It's amazing.
I mean, obviously it's not just that, but there's a lot of that. So I was thinking about like just taking that idea to the extreme.
Yeah.
Basically.
Have you had any encounters with Dylan?
I was hired to make a guitar strap for him once, but it was like a corporate gift from, I think, Maple Leaf Gardens, because he was playing there.
Okay.
So I mean he also doesn't really play guitar anymore, and I was like, this is like, you guys should be thinking about this more. And whatever, but you know, I took the job and the money, and who knows, it's probably just sitting in the dressing room still.
Did you like embed a secret note or anything?
That's the closest I've. I did not. No, I did what I was told.
Did anyone with that Plugs record come out of the woodwork who was like in that band?
Well, we had to deal with his manager for that. So that, I mean, but I let Roddy, the bass player, kind of take the lead on that because he cares about Bob Dylan a lot more than I do. I mean, not that I don't care, but he's like, you know, he's pretty mad for it.
Yeah.
So he got to be in charge of that project for that reason.
Was that a headache?
No, it was pretty mellow from what I understand. They were just like, you know, here's the agreement. And it was like a one page deal.
Got it. They're like, you crazy Canadians.
Yeah,
it was,
yeah totally.
What's your amplifier situation these days? You've got the Grecos. What's the complement to those?
Well, usually I use a Fender Champ for literally everything, mm-hmm. including bass. But right now, what is here is one of a Blues Junior,
yep.
which has some interesting sounds. If you get weird with it, it has like kind of, you can sort of get like a broken amplifier kind of sound, like sort of Keith Richards or something.
Mm-hmm.
It might be that the guitars are broken. I don't know what's broken, but I think whatever is happening sounds all right. Something is wrong, but it's, you know, it's working.
Yeah. Did you, how did you find these Grecos? I didn't even ask.
I bought them on the internet.
Of course.
Yeah.
Every musician I know, and even every music venue I know this year has just rocked their world in a really awful way. Has this exercise of putting out album after album, putting out a poetry book, has it changed the way you're going to think about if we ever get a normal year again?
I mean, it's kind of what it's just that I've been enabled to do what I've always been trying to do anyway. You know, Steve and you've changed are much more understanding with my output, and usually he'll just let me do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when we were with New West, and understandably so, I don't hold any grudge against them for this, but it was like, you know, they were functioning in an old way, which is, you know, the 1 year record with the 6 month rollout. And it just doesn't work well for me because I get frustrated and I'm sitting on material that I then abandon because there's newer material that I'm more interested in. And so like there's these records of time that just become obsolete because it's an immediate thing, right? It's a recording of time.
Mm-hmm.
And those things don't grow. They don't, like, you know what I mean? They don't evolve. That's the problem with recording in general. And so if they're not immediately there as a testament of their time, then what, you know, what do you, then they have no value anymore. I mean, that's how I feel about every record I've ever put out, but
yeah.
It's different when you're sitting on it. It's harder to be like, okay, now let's put out these ideas I had 2 years ago. It's like, well, those are stupid ideas now.
Mm-hmm. In the perfect world, again, COVID aside, how, in your head, mm-hmm. how often would you play out? How often would you do a concert?
Less than we do, probably. But,
sure.
But maybe, I don't know. It's hard because right now it's like, oh, it sure would be fun to like do a show, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I would take probably just like longer gaps, I think, between tours, because sometimes we tend to go a little too hard. And I think that's my fault because I have abstained from flying for so long that when we go to Europe, it's such a pain in the ass to get me there and back. And
how do you get there?
It's like I take a boat.
From where?
Brooklyn, Red Hook, Brooklyn to Southampton, England.
How long does that take?
Exactly a week.
Who else is on that boat?
Sunday to Sunday.
What's it like?
Old British and German people.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, is it like a over-the-top cruise ship like you see in the Bahamas, or is it just totally utilitarian?
It's like the Titanic. Like, you have to wear a tuxedo to dinner and stuff, which I like that part.
You're kidding me, right?
But yeah, I mean, no, I'm not. I'm not joking at all.
You have to wear a tuxedo to dinner?
Not every night.
Wow.
But some of the nights.
Do you get
yeah.
a steamer
but
trunk?
You have to wear a suit. No.
Okay.
But you can bring as much as you can carry, which is a big benefit of doing it. Unlike a airplane where you pretty much can't bring anything without it costing you $1 million. So I usually bring like all the records and, you know, everybody's guitars, which I can't actually carry on my own, but I just like heavily tip the, people at the dock. They load it onto the boat and off of the boat for me, and there's a cart, you know, so it's and it all has to go in my stateroom, but it's fine. And when I'm, you know, I'm just sleeping in there, no big deal.
So the rest of the band flies ahead of you or after you?
Yeah or way after me. Yeah,
incredible. I had no
and
idea.
And that's the other thing, we have to schedule around the Queen Mary. Whenever the Queen Mary is going is when we have to schedule the tours. So it's like, okay, well, the tour will go from when it arrives this Sunday to however close we can get to, you know, a Sunday 2 months from then or whatever it is.
Wow. I know you just mentioned a fiance, but do you normally take this cruise by yourself, or can you convince anyone to take it with you?
I've taken it with, you know, like Kenny, our sound engineer, has come with me a bunch of times, and he likes it. And there's been a few times where we've all gone, and that's been nice because we can have, you know, fancy dinners together and stuff and unwind. But yeah, it's not as fun alone.
So that really defines like, where you can play is the flying thing.
Yeah, or at least, you know, yeah, when for sure, and for how long, and all of that. A lot of driving, a lot of being at sea.
Yeah. Have you ever been in a plane?
Yeah, I used to fly, like, too much, and it just kind of, you know, got a little too intense for me.
Got it.
But I recently to get down here to reunite, I had to fly because it's the only way to cross the border right now.
How did you
coming
do?
Into America? Well, what I did was we had been separated for like 4 months, and it was the absolute worst. And it was like, no, you know, I have a border guard friend, and I was talking to him. He's like, there's nothing. I don't know what to tell you, you know? And then suddenly I guess this had been the rule the whole time, but there's so much conflicting information and everything we didn't know, but they were allowing Canadians to fly into America. You just can't drive. So then it's a matter of me overcoming a fear that has, you know, kept me from flying for the last 8 years in order to get here, which, you know, was the perfect reasoning for overcoming that. And so I flew from Toronto to Detroit, which is at the longest, a 40-minute flight.
Okay.
And then I rented a car and drove the rest of the way. Wow. So I flew virtually over the border.
Yeah.
The shortest possible. You know what I mean? Because I was like, all right, I'm not going to do. I don't think I can handle 3.5-4 hours. And I, you know, it felt good. It felt like, because I'd spent that time, you know, imagining it, you know, Because when you have like a fear, especially an irrational fear, I don't know, well, at least for me, I spent a lot of time just like, what is it even like? I don't remember. And like, I remember hating it. And like any time I've ever flown, even before I stopped, obviously, I would just have to stare out the window. No one could talk to me. And I would just be clenching my seatbelt with one of my hands the whole time. Wow. And that's just what it got to. And I was just like sick with anxiety for months before, knowing that I would have to be flying. And it was just like really destroying my life. But I don't know. I felt very at ease that time. I mean, it was short. I'm sure if I was doing a transatlantic flight, it would be a very different story. Mm-hmm. But yeah, weather was ideal. It was a perfect way to kind of overcome that. And I don't feel like I've fully done that, but I have agreed to do. There's theoretically European tour like this time next year, and I've agreed to do a flight on it. Not to it, but within it.
Oh, okay.
And it's, it's 3 hours.
Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah. So I have to do that now if touring exists.
Is the boat ride prohibitively expensive? I imagine it must be a lot more than a plane flight.
It depends. It's somewhere you can get them sometimes for like $700.
Oh, okay.
But sometimes they're like 12, 13, and that's one way.
Yeah.
So it's like almost double, probably, like if you're getting good flight prices, but you also, it's like a week of whatever, thinking and working and eating well.
I know you have a label. I know they want you to not put out records right now, but can a musician such as yourself, if maybe not every single Wednesday, but if you wanted to, is there a way to make a living just doing the Bandcamp thing that you were doing? Or is it just, I'm doing this and it's kind of a hobby to kill time while we wade this thing out?
I think it would be a matter of maintaining interest, which I think would be hard, because there is, you know, there is the idea of oversaturating yourself to be considered. And I know that there are, I'm aware that there are people who would be happy if I put out a record every single week and would maintain that feeling.
Sure.
But I think it would also probably have negative effects eventually.
Yeah. Well, I wonder too if, and maybe you'll correct me, but I know you like to move on from things that you recorded a long time ago, but maybe there were some records in that 5 or 6 span where you're like, that one actually deserved a little more love than the other one.
I felt that way about like a lot of them. Yeah. But you know, I don't know. I mean, I put out 2 records a couple of years ago for the duration of a tour.
Yeah.
And I felt that way about those records. And I still kind of do. Like I would like them to exist physically. But that seems indulgent. I don't know. I mean, the whole thing is really, isn't it?
I don't know. You're doing something interesting. You directed a music video. Is that another one of your hobbies, is like getting behind the editing bay for videos?
Oh yeah, I love doing that. I mean, it's usually like walk in with 0 ideas and a camera and just like hope that something of value materializes, you know. Mm-hmm.
Do you have for all that?
Yeah. Actually, Kenny, our sound engineer, is sort of more prepared for those kinds of things now. He's taken an interest. He's sort of like the perfect tech boy, you know. He's just like into all that stuff, and he also has like, I mean, he's like very good at mixing, and also he's very good at framing things, which I suppose is like the same kind of thinking. You know, And so, yeah, so he's got a real knack for that. And I just let him do whatever he thinks. And I just point at stuff and tell people what to do.
Yeah. I'm in awe, like I said, of how efficient you are in your workflow, especially because I tend to suffer from, you know, writer's block, which is BS. It just means I'm procrastinating or whatever. You don't do some things though. Like, you're not on social media every day. What are your personal rules about how you spend your time every day?
I just like to be creative. It's what I enjoy most about life. You know, so I don't think about anything else, really. And that is probably there's probably some downfalls to that. But there's also, you know, I have a beautiful curated team of people that have been refined over the years who I trust and love, and they understand me and what, you know, the way that I function and how to navigate that. So it's become very streamlined and functional, and, you know, I couldn't ask for anything more than that, you know?
Yeah. Are these people who kind of work for the Daniel Romano?
Well, it's basically just the band. The band and Steve, you've changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Those are the only people I work with, you know.
That's true. You're like the Andy Warhol model. You've got like your factory.
Yeah. Yes. And it's taken a long time to get it where it needed to be. But it's, I do feel like it's there, and I can trust everybody who is involved, which is really, really nice.
Is your space back in Canada where you don't want to remove the microphone? Is that a house? Is that a studio next to a house? What's your kind of
It's a house. Yeah, yeah. It's like the living room is the studio. Yeah.
Cool. And is that
and if I'm doing, sometimes I'll drive over to my parents' house if I'm going to do drums, because they don't sound that good in the living room. My parents have a living room that has a crawl space under it, so it's kind of floating, and it's a much nicer frequency range that you get out of the drum kit there.
And they're just used to you taking over.
But
I usually
only use three microphones on a drum kit anyway, but it's just better.
Yeah,
it's more nicer bottom end, I guess, or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're usually cool with me coming over for a couple hours and banging out a record's worth of drums.
Have they been hearing that since you were a teenager?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. They're used to it.
Yeah, that's awesome. So after Texas, is Canada back home, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, nice. We're going up there. And then, I don't know, probably just sort of the same momentum, but there. And I don't know. No, I mean, nobody does. We'll just kind of see what happens and how it's dealt with.
Has the change of scenery, I mean, you kind of already got the like deep country stuff out of your way, out of the career, like early on, but like, has being in Texas changed your output in any way that you can see?
I wouldn't say so, but that's just because we've just kind of been inside, you know what I mean? I'm not consuming the culture here, really, you know, outside of the buildings we're living in, which is different, of course, but I wouldn't say that it's like Texan to the point where it's like, you know, creeping its way into whatever I'm doing. You know, I would say that like the workflow and aesthetic and sort of creative eye of my partner is definitely influencing me, and I think vice versa, and that's beautiful, of course, but I don't think that that's particularly Texan, other than the fact that she's Texan.
Yeah. Is she a fellow artist?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so that's nice. We just have our little areas where we work and then we share and gently critique.
It's great. So you have a new record coming out. Remind me of the date on
September 18, I think.
And anything else that, any surprises maybe between now and the end of the year, or just should we just be kept on our toes?
Well, I don't, not that I'm currently aware of, and or not that I'm, I don't think I'm allowed to surprise you.
Okay.
But I don't know. My partner and I made another music video for another single, which I think will come out before the record is released. And it has a horse in it. So that's nice.
There's some Texas.
That's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Daniel, thank you so much. I'm, you know,
hey, it's my pleasure.
You're
thank
one
you.
Of my favorite musicians. I know you came to the office of, I don't know, 2 years ago or whatever, and that was great to meet you. But yeah, I'm in so in awe of what you do, and look forward to the next time our paths cross. Yeah.
Yeah, likewise.